Okay, so good afternoon. After that, we graded the midterm as of today. Grades are posted on, exams are posted on TPEX. There is a key on Colab. If you want to check things, we have some weird special cases, like sometimes we decided randomly deciding was an okay answer or not doing it was okay, and some things. But if you have regrades, please submit them. Otherwise, this is the distribution. So the median is about 84, mean about an 81. And this is sort of a continuous approximation of a histogram, so as not to have you obsess over 1 point changes and little anomalies. So any questions about midterm logistics? Everyone, I assume, has used TPEX before to view exams. And that's how I'll take regrade requests. If you have any, yeah. No, but you, I can add a link to that. But it's tpegs.cs.virginia.edu should work. Yes?
Do you have like a regrade policy, like if we put in a regrade for 4 points, but we don't get them, like use more points?
Question is about regrade policy. So I will set a deadline for regrades, I guess a week from Friday probably. I'll look at things after that, but no guarantees. Generally, if you ask me to regrade something, I might look over other parts of the exam and regrade them, especially if I want to be consistent about, if you interpreted something in one way and that makes question one correct, don't expect, and makes question two wrong, don't be surprised if I decide, oh, okay. Otherwise, no rules about discouraging people from submitting regrades, just please be responsible. And generally, so I don't plan on doing any direct scaling of the exam. I will, at the end of the semester, I will look at the distribution of overall grades and figure out how to assign letter grades in some manner, which is basically look for gaps and also look at, okay, if someone has an 80, what does that mean a typical person with an 80 average in the course did on the assignments, and what do I think that means? Okay, so last time, which before the midterm review and all that, which you probably don't really remember, we were talking about stack smashing. So stack smashing was a way of taking a type of vulnerability, namely buffer overflows, and it was a technique for exploiting it. And it was a very nice technique because the condition we needed to be satisfied for stack smashing to work was we had a buffer on the stack that we could overflow. That is the only condition we need, and after satisfying that condition, we could pretty much always turn this into a way where the attacker could run whatever they wanted. And the basic procedure was you inserted machine code, usually in the buffer, and you overwrote a return address by taking advantage of the code going beyond the end of the buffer into whatever was on the stack, which always includes return addresses. And there's some tricky bits in stack smashing that we dealt with. So one thing is that you had to put this machine code in there. We needed it to actually work. So we needed to construct machine code that worked in any executable, even though we didn't use the normal linking and compiling process to produce this machine code. And like with viruses inserting their code in an executable, we had some concerns, very similar concerns, that we needed the code to be relocatable. We didn't know where it would end up, and we didn't want to spend the time writing individualized machine code and figuring out all the offsets for everything. It's much easier to just write code which we can put and it works anytime. So we construct this sort of exploit template once and we use it on every single application we find. And this is what people do in practice that you can find. And we have linked in the homework for this week, archives of shellcode, that are just pre-built. Here's a piece of code that will run in any executable, almost any executable. The archive is not as good as you might think, but that will run in any executable that you can use to do this. And this means that unlike our naturally generated code, we need relative addressing within the machine code. We can't hard code an address like compilers often end up doing in some LEA instruction or similar. And we need absolute addressing of anything in the program we're referencing. So if we're referencing a library function, you better use an absolute address, even though that's, for example, not how calls work in x86. And we also had this extra constraint. With viruses, when they were infecting an executable, they could put whatever they wanted. We have some constraints, which might seem, you know, naively to have been a death knell for this stack smashing technique to be so universal, that we need the machine code to be valid input. When we have a buffer overflow, often it's from, say, copying into a buffer until you see a new line or a null character. And that means you can't use the new line or a null character or whatever else the code that's copying is expecting as part of your shellcode. But as you know, that machine code you want to run. But machine code is very flexible. We can look at what instructions those restrictions let us do. Usually we can figure out a way to do everything. So one example of where you could get into trouble is if, let's say, the buffer overflow is caused by a function that deals with C strings, which end in a null character, then you can't put nulls in it and have it continue processing it as if it's more string to write to that buffer we're overflowing. So something like this, the natural way of putting a constant in the register, has a bunch of zeros in its encoding because it encodes this constant hex 100 as a 4-byte integer which has 2 0 bytes in it. I used the wrong width thing, but it should be AX, not AL. But you can use something like this to get around that. You use a move instruction which takes a shorter constant to avoid having zeros in there. But you need to actually think about these tricks when you're constructing the machine code sometimes. But it's not actually a big deal. And if you look at the sort of shellcode archives that exist out there, they usually have machine code which happens not to contain any new lines or spaces or null characters, which doesn't actually take too much effort to do. And you can even do this under real restrictions, though that usually doesn't end up coming up. People who are sloppy enough to have something which overflows a buffer usually aren't careful enough to really filter their input a lot. So the other thing we need to do is we need to find the location of the return address. And this is one of the things which wasn't really a nicely solved problem. Now, we have the advantage that it's usually a fixed offset from the buffer. We have a buffer allocated as part of running a function, and it's allocated by subtracting something from the stack pointer, which initially points to the return address. Maybe multiple subtractions, but just ending up subtracting a fixed quantity from the stack pointer. So we can figure it out from the assembly, but it's going to actually vary. If we see some C code that's vulnerable, we don't actually know exactly what the offset is. We can guess, but you know, the compiler might need to save something on the stack, it might not. The compiler might add some padding to align the buffer for some reason, it might not. So this is a bit tedious. This is something where we actually need our sort of reverse engineering skills to look at the executable. Although I'll show you today a sort of, I want to look at as little assembly as possible strategy for this. And then we need to find the location that we inserted the code. So we need to find the address of the buffer because that's what we end up writing to the return address slot. So once we figure out where it is relative to the buffer, we need to actually put it in there. And generally the way we do this is that we say, okay, well, you know, the stack starts at the same place every time and we're running the same program and I know how the program is run, so I can just do that, right? And if you've read, so who here has started the assignment that is due a week from Friday? So a couple people. So if you started that, you notice we had some instructions about running some funny command. That's because things don't quite work this way. So here's a simple little program. So I have a variable, and then I take a pointer to it. And since I'm taking a pointer to it, it has to be stored in memory. Since this is a local variable to a function, it's going to be stored on the stack. So this is a way of, in C, printing out the address of at least something in a fixed location on the stack. And you run this program several times, and you get completely different numbers. Running it the exact same way in the exact same shell, I get completely different numbers. So this is what you'll see today. So this is something called address space layout randomization. It also has a whole bunch of other names. And we're going to talk about this later. But basically, this deliberately varies the location of the stack and is doing it precisely because of stack smashing and things like that. We'll talk about it later in the semester and also talk about ways in which it's maybe less good than you might think it is. But right now, for the things we're talking about, this will seem really, really bad for these exploits. And you might think, well, this solves all that problem, all those problems, but it doesn't really in practice. So most of the techniques, most of the sort of buffer overflows and other things which cause vulnerabilities are still problems. And they're still exploited even in executables that do this. So we can disable this feature in Linux. And you might gather from there being a way to disable it that maybe some applications don't want it on. So it turns out there's probably some programs which this feature breaks. Some programs which accidentally depend on the stack being in the right place, which is why the quote-unquote right place, which is why there's a way to turn it off. And the command to turn it off is this setArch command. This is a kind of confusing command because we tell you to run it like this. And what this does is it runs the program bash, which is a shell, the same one you log into, but it runs a new copy of it with some things changed. And the two things changed are this minus R and minus L option, which with minus B tells you what they are. So it disables address randomization and activates something called a compatible layout. So after I do that, so I've disabled this feature, which is meant to combat stack smashing and the like, I get a nice consistent stack location. So, and this is how it used to be. So address space layout randomization is surprisingly new. Probably 2005, 2006, it's being common. It's been talked about before. And for reasons we'll talk about when we get to it, it used to be very ineffective. And is still very ineffective on some systems. So without it, we got a nice consistent location. So now we can do stack smashing, right? Okay. So that's what it would seem like. So this is how I can sort of find the stack location in a synthetic example. So how am I going to do it in a real program? If I give you a program and you want to know where the stack is, you can't actually just modify it to add this because you'll change what's on the stack, which will keep you from actually knowing where the return address is in the real executable you're trying to exploit. So what's a way to figure out where the stack is if I give you a binary? Yeah. Yeah, so one thing we could do is we can do like we had on the midterm, you look at the assembly and you say, okay, how much does the stack pointer change? Where is the return address relative to the stack pointer? And you can figure it out that way. And you can know where the initial location of the stack is and count all the functions that are called beforehand, how much they change the stack, and you can do this logic to figure out the exact location. This is definitely possible, but pretty annoying. And also, you need to know where the stack starts initially. But I guess you could figure that out from this. So you know where the stack starts, you look at every single function that's called, you count how much it uses, and you add that all up. That's doable, but probably not what you want to be doing. So the most natural thing to do is to run the program in a debugger. and you can just print out what's the stack pointer. And this way, instead of having to look at what are all the functions that call this function doing, you just look at that function and you know where the stack started. And maybe you can even like print out the address of the buffer directly. You can just look in the assembly, know when a register contains that address, and print that out. So using a debugger is usually what people would prefer to do, though you don't have to. You can do it just on paper with a copy of the executable, assuming you know where the stack starts, which presumably is fixed. So let's explore this strategy with our synthetic program here. So this X should be very close to where the stack pointer is when we're in main. So let's print out the stack pointer in main and compare and make sure we're getting the right number. So I did that. So here we're at FE064. This is with address space layout randomization disabled. Then I set a breakpoint on main, I run this program, and I print out the stack pointer, and whoa, that's not actually that close. We're like off by like 100. Which is probably further than you want to be. So even if we assume, so either main is putting, like 100 bytes between the stack pointer and X, the X we're printing the address of, or the stack started in a different location, even though I turned off randomization, and even though I get a consistent result when I'm not running in the debugger. This is, yeah. Yes, so this might lead us to the conclusion that the debugger changes where the stack is. And that is, in fact, basically what's happening. And the problem here is that there's a system by which Linux sets up the initial stack. And we sort of see a hint in this, in that this value here is not actually close to the top of the stack. The top of the stack, where the stack starts, is at address, all these F's and another F instead of an E, 000. That's where the stack starts. It's around there. So we're already way down. So there's something on the stack above main. And that, in fact, that something is a variable length. And on Linux, the reason this happens is because you have things like we run our program with some arguments. And there's other information like that, which has to be put somewhere for the program to use. And Linux could have like malloced it, but it doesn't. The way it passes things like arguments and another thing which are kind of like arguments called environment variables to programs is by putting it on their stack when they start it. So this is how the Linux operating system decided that programs will get their arguments. They could have done something else, but they put it on the stack. So this is what's initially on the stack when you run our program. So we have environment variables. So who here has used environment variables ever? Seen them? So a couple people. So a common example of an environment variable is the path environment variable. This says, where can I find programs to run? So when you type a command like ls in your shell, it looks at this environment variable, looks at each of the directories it lists, and looks for ls in each of those locations. And that's useful to have in the environment because the shell isn't the only thing which wants to know where can I find something like ls or some other application the user wants me to run. So we pass that to every program. And that's passed in these environment variables. There's other environment variables like home. There's a whole lot of these. So these are all dumped on the stack. And the way it works in Linux is that we dump the environment variables on the stack, yes, literally as a string with an equal sign. And this, there's a null terminator after each of these strings. These are like C strings. And then we dump the arguments to the program on the stack. And the arguments to the program include any command line arguments, like foo and bar up here that I passed, and the name I use to run the program. So if I run the program with .test.exe, that appears in a string. If I run it with /home/cr4bd and so on, that appears in those arguments. So the most obvious thing that the debugger changes is that if we look at this debugging output, oh, it's saying I'm starting this program. So it's probably passing that as the first, as the sort of quote unquote zeroth argument, as this string here. Whereas when I was running in my shell, I was passing .stackload.exe. So that explains like 40 characters of difference, 40 difference in the stack location. It also turns out there's some difference in the environment variables. So the size of the environment variables in the arguments and the number there are, because in addition to putting them there, we have a list of pointers to them, to the environment variables, and a list of pointers to the command line args. Who's here has used argv in C or C++? So if you've used argv, this argv points to here. This pointer to .text.exe, which is followed by a pointer to foo. This is what argv points to. And on Linux, this is set up by actually the operating system kernel, the thing which implements exec, executing things. As part of loading a program, it sets up argv like this. Has the array of pointers is put on the stack. But the space needed for that and for the environment variables drastically affects where the stack starts. Yeah?
So the space used after turning off the red resist, once we figure out all the space used by these extra arguments, we're able to find out the stack pointer consistently?
So the question is, once we figure out the space used by these, you can find out the stack pointer consistently? Yes. This is not the strategy I recommend for the homework. So in the homework, the buffer you are overflowing is large. It is large enough that you can use the knot sled technique we talked about. Just have a big string of knots and choose an address that's probably in the middle. This will let you, this way, instead of finding out the exact location of the stack, you need to find out the location of the stack within a couple hundred. And that will make things much easier for you. Because yes, you absolutely could figure out, if I run the program the way in the instructions, where is the stack pointer? By looking at your debugger output and carefully making the appropriate adjustments. But first of all, that's going to be very annoying for us to grade. Because your environments aren't actually that consistent. What we're probably going to do is we're probably going to look at your program, your exploit output, find where the return address is in there, and make sure it's close enough, and adjust it ourselves to make your exploit work consistently. But it would be much easier for you to just, get something with the debugger and figure out guess how much off it could be. Like, it's probably not off by more than like 200, and you have enough room in the buffer we've given you that you can make sure that if it's off by 200, you still hit you still hit a knot which is in front of the code you actually want to run. And this is what people do in practice. They very rarely, if they're overflowing a buffer, do they not have a little bit of room to work with. So they don't need to get it spot on. They can be off by like at least tens. And this is a particularly actually annoying to figure this out. Where's my shell? So printenv is a command which prints all environment variables. So let me show you all environment variables in my shell right now on my laptop. It's a pretty big list. And yes, you could figure out how this changes in the debugger. So let's debug printenv and run that and look at it. But I don't think you can quickly figure out what changed in the environment, but something did. That is presently on the screen. And that thing actually is this underscore equals user bin GDB right here. Wasn't set that way. But that is not worth your time to do, but it does change. And that's a reason that's going to come up when you do the homework, this isn't the same as in the debugger. Yes, it isn't. But if you do things well and we give you plenty of leeway, you won't have a problem with, you know, being close enough. And you really should do that, because I will try not to take off points if you like make your exploit be pin precision to a stack location, but it's not going to save you time. Yeah. So there is a 1-byte no-op instruction on x86, so you do not. If there wasn't, yes, you would. Or if you use multi-byte no-ops, you would have to. Okay, so I should tell you some things about using GDB. So let's talk about how we might do this project, the first homework with GDB. And so I have a vulnerable program here. Okay, this overflows a buffer. And I want to figure out the information I need to get with the debugger. And I want to avoid having to like carefully read assembly all the time. So what's the most I can do with GDB? So let me pull up my script. Okay. So first we're gonna make sure that we are running without address space layout randomization. I'm glad I have this in my script so I don't do that. And I have a convenient, I have an executable here, which is probably the meaner than the one we've given you. So let me show you this vulnerable executable here, where I have stripped out all the symbols, so you can't even, you need to figure out yourself where functions are. And I know this is vulnerable to a Stack Overflow. I don't, in this case, there are no function names in the executable part here to even let me name the function where it is. So I want to figure out, how do I go about exploiting this? This is like a real program you might get commercially, which probably not going to have debug information. Yeah?
If you look for like a big subtraction of the
R. Yeah, so one strategy is we could actually go through this code, and we could say, okay, you know, I can look through here, and probably there's going to be a subtraction with RSP somewhere, and probably that's where the buffer is, so I can set a breakpoint there. So this is something we could do. So I want to exploit this program. I don't have information. I don't even have function names here. I don't know what this function is called. I don't, you know, but I can guess that way. But there's a more reliable technique. So I have badge strict here. I'm just going to, I have this convenient input file, which contains 1,000 A's. I'm gonna run it with that. And what do you think is gonna happen? We're gonna break something. We're gonna have a segfault, in fact. So I'm gonna run this, and it segfaults. Yeah, so we can do, so if we want to figure out how do I exploit this, like where is the buffer I'm overflowing, we just run this in a debugger after doing this. And note that this meant that I didn't need to, like, even though for the homework it's a fine strategy, but I didn't need to like look through the program and figure out where is the vulnerability. I just said, okay, this causes a crash. That probably means there's something I can exploit here. So let's look at the crash. So I'm gonna run bash strict with GDB, and then I'm going to just run it in the debugger, inputting from my input file with 1,000 A's. And I get a segfault. And look, the debugger tells me the address the segfault occurred at. I don't need to guess what function might have the problem. It tells me right where the return is that has the, or whatever other thing went wrong that happened because we overflowed this buffer. So I can say, okay, what is the instruction at this address? So RIP is the program counter, the current instruction. So an XI, so XI stands for print out memory as instructions. So I can see, okay, So I can print out the address of the current thing we're at as an instruction, and it's a return. So we're crashing on a return. So this tells us that we overflowed into the return address, just like we wanted to do stack smashing. And this tells us where the return is. And that means that it also means that I know roughly where we are. I can like look at where we are in the stack right now and know roughly what the stack address is of how far in we are to the buffer, but I don't know the beginning. So I don't know the offset. I don't know exactly where in the buffer I need to put the return address yet. But I can look at the code around here. So I can print out, this is print out memory as 10 instructions starting with, let's say, RIP minus 20, and I will hope that's not in the middle of an instruction. And luckily it wasn't, because we end with this return that we're at. So I see, okay, so before this, we have this A to I, we have this code here. This looks like a write to a buffer here, because we're writing to something based on the stack and another index. So that looks like our write to the buffer. Yes? So the question is, so I'm examining the instructions in GDB rather than like using object dump. And I started at 20 bytes minus our current pointer. What happens if I started in the middle of an instruction? So probably minus 19 is the middle of this LEA instruction here. So what's going to happen? So the debugger is trying really hard, but it's starting in the middle of an instruction, and it gets confused. And it's pretty obvious it gets confused, and that's usually going to be the case. Yeah?
So what is that? That means that that's not an instruction that it can interpret, yeah. Or it doesn't exist?
Yeah, so what happened here is it decoded the first 2 bytes of this LEA as a JL, and then like two or three bytes as an OR, and a couple bytes as that, and then it got to the end of this WTL in that encoding instruction, and it found a byte, which wasn't a valid instruction. So in this case, the reason we're seeing it, in this case, not the only reason, is because I'm starting in the middle of an instruction. So if I try to read the middle of an instruction as instructions, I get things which aren't instructions sometimes. Another reason you could have it is because not everything in an executable is instructions. Like it could be a string. And that won't disassemble as instructions. So when you did tricky, you inserted some virus code, which included a constant string. That string, if you tried to disassemble it with object dump, includes like all these bad instructions, because it's not meant to be instructions. But object dump tries really hard to interpret it as x86 instructions. But we never use it that way, and it's not why it's there. Okay, so we know that from this little snippet of disassembly here, we know that this probably, because that's a write to something based on the stack pointer and another variable, that's probably where we're writing to the buffer. And I'd like to figure out where the buffer begins. So something I can do is I can just say, okay, why don't I just set a breakpoint at that write and look at where it's writing to the first time. So I can set a breakpoint. So the syntax to set a breakpoint at a particular instruction is break or B, and then a star, and then the address of an instruction. So in this case, 4005FE. So I'll set a breakpoint there. And now I will run the program again from the beginning. I'll kill the old one and run it again with 1,000 A's of input. Okay, so there's my breakpoint is hit, and I can look at what instruction am I at? I'm at this move 1 byte, move a 0. Oh, wait, that's probably not the right instruction. So we're moving a constant 0, not the buffer. So one thing we could do is we could say, well, this is at the end of the buffer probably, because we're probably null terminating it. So we could make a guess based on RBP. Is that 1,000 bytes? Yeah. So RBP is 1,000. So we can guess based on that, that OXC plus RSP is probably the beginning of the buffer. That's one way we could guess. We could also look back further in the code and say, oh, so that's where I'm adding zero. Say, okay, so I stopped at this instruction where I'm adding a zero, but that didn't look like it's actually where I'm writing the beginning of the buffer. It's probably up here, where I'm moving a not constant. People look confused. So this is the code we stopped at here, because I looked at around my return, and I said, what's my first guess for where we're writing the buffer? And I said, okay, there's a move to state location in the stack. So we can say from this, okay, probably REP is an index to the buffer, and OXC is the start. That's one thing we can do. And we looked at REP stopping here, and it's 1,000, which is the number of characters in our string. So this is probably adding a zero at the end. So that gives us one piece of evidence that, oh yeah, we probably actually have found the beginning of the buffer, and it's probably at RSP plus OXC. So this is probably the beginning of the buffer. We can verify that by saying where we're writing the first thing in the buffer, and just say, no. And we could just set a breakpoint up here and use that to verify. So I have a different technique for verifying this. And that's that, you know, we've been fiddling around with just setting breakpoints in GDB. So we're setting a breakpoint at the place where we think we're writing the buffer and trying to figure out where the buffer is based on what we know about the disassembly around there. So that's certainly doable and pretty reasonable if you can figure out, like here, it's pretty obvious from the assembly that that's probably, that, you know, it's based on the stack pointer and this is probably an index into the buffer. But sometimes it might not be. And you might still want to know, like, where are we writing the buffer? How many characters in are we, and so on. So what are some strategies you could use to do that without, you know, having to interpret the assembly like this? So what's the purely experimental way to figure out how far into the buffer we are is the return addresses? Sorry? Yeah, so we could try a bunch of things, and we just need a reliable way of detecting when we've started to overwrite the return address. So one thing we could do is we could use the breakpoint we have set at this return, and we could just say, did I change the return address this time? You want to do that just in case you only overwrite it by one byte, so you know exactly when that byte happens. But you could look at that. That would be one way you could figure it out. See when the return address, what the return address value is at that ret with different buffer lengths, and see where's the changeover. So another thing we can do is we can use another GDB feature that people usually don't know about, which is, so we'll continue to the next breakpoint. So we're at our return again. And we know the address of the stack here is this address when we run it in the debugger. And GDB has a feature called watchpoints. So I know that I'm changing this address with my buffer overflow. And I can ask GDB, hey, why don't you tell me when I'm changing a certain address? So I can take an address like this one, I'll just, and say, I would like to watch that address. And this is like a breakpoint, but it looks at a memory location. So it says hardware watch point. So it watches for changes to a memory location. And if I kill the program and start it up again, we see that we run, and then GDB says, oh my, you changed the stack at that address. This was the stack pointer just in front of the return address, as it turned out. So I figured out, I got to our RET, and I figured out where the stack was. And I tell GDB, why don't you watch that memory location, and I'm going to run the program again. And you tell me when it first changes. So this one probably isn't important because we're not, this one, well, so this might be, this is the probably when we're setting up the return address and such the first time. Okay, because that's the first change that's going to happen to that thing in the stack, assuming this is the first function call. So we'll continue. So something got called, and we're going to wait until we're probably actually calling the appropriate function just before the crash. So we know we get to the crash of here, there. So we're going to wait until we're at this change here. So that's this last thing before the crash, the last time we changed that stack pointer, that stack location, was at this location. And that's probably the place where our buffer was overflowing. So we had some before then, and what they probably were was the rest of the program called functions which used the stack. But the last time, that probably, right there, this tells us, okay, that's where the write of this buffer was happening. So we can, up here. That's where the write of the buffer was happening. This first change is up here. So we can watch more carefully. So these are where we were changing. You notice these gradual changes. So why do we have these gradual changes to the value I was watching? Yeah. Yeah, so if you look at, okay, what's this final value here, let's say? And let's print out that value and xf, that's 97. What's 97? Really? I thought I could do this. 97 is A. So that's where we're starting to print out A's. And if we look up here, we had cases where we were adding, we changed the value to probably from 0 to A and probably a bunch of more A's. And that's probably what these values represent. So we know that this overwrite is happening at 4005D6. And if we run the program until we have a breakpoint at 4005D6, right here, that's probably where we're actually writing to our buffer. This is just above because we were printing out the return address and return pops. It doesn't, so it looks below the stack pointer, I think. But so we can say, okay, so okay, so this is the first change. We're pushing something onto the stack. That was the next one. Here, okay. And what? I am confused. Okay, I apparently did not script this demo correctly. Okay, that's the problem. Sorry. When GDP has a watch point, something I should have written in my handy demo cheat sheet, it triggers the watch point in the instruction after. And that's why I was so confused. So right here, we got a watch point triggered, and this program counter was at this increment instruction, which is around, which is just after this actual thing we saw earlier, which is what's writing to the stack. And we can say from here, we can look at the assembly around this, and we can guess that if we're incrementing RBX, that's probably the index into the buffer. And we can say, well, this is the time we're overwriting that stack pointer, that return address, and we can say, oh, it's 125 bytes in, about. And this strategy, because I set a watch point, so in a function which was more complicated, where I couldn't just examine the assembly like I could do here, like we've had you do for exercises, to figure out where's the buffer, what's going on, you don't actually need to figure everything out. So the debugger tools let you say, you know, watch for a change to an address, so you can just trigger the write and then look at the assembly around that location, rather than needing to look at the whole function. Also, I wanted to bring this up because most people aren't aware of what like GDB can do. So GDB has features like watch your changes in a memory address, or set a breakpoint at a particular assembly instruction, or disassemble some piece of memory. So you can also use this to like debug your exploit. So you can like say, okay, I think I loaded the machine code at this address that I want to run. Let's look at that piece of memory and see if it looks like what I expect. Okay, and I apologize for demo fumbling. And as another note on this, so on our course, linked off the course webpage, I have a cheat sheet for GDB because people usually don't figure this out from the GDB manual. With things relevant to this course you might want to do. So you've probably seen some of these before. You probably haven't seen watch points before. I did a watch point with just star, so it was looking for the whole like 8-byte value changing, but you can do it with different sizes, and so on. You can also set a watch point for reads, if you want to do that. And you can clear all these. And there's ways of looking at memory in a consistent way. And disassembling in Intel syntax if you hate AT&T syntax. Okay. So back to things. So we looked at stack smashing, and your assignment is to actually do stack smashing. And I spent a lot of time telling you sort of more mechanics of like, how do I figure out where the, you know, what can I do to figure out where things are in a program? You know, is it really as bad as, do I have to like figure out the function? And no, there's shortcuts. In addition to just guessing. Like, you can guess where things are in the buffer address. You can figure out, you can figure out exactly where the overwrite of the return address occurs, and you can pretty quickly figure this stuff out. So now that we know how to do it, how do we stop it? So what are our options for stopping stack smashing? What steps can we stop? Yeah. So we could filter our input. Yeah. Keep the size right. Yeah. So we could do bounds checking everywhere. And that's a great idea, and we're going to talk about that later. But people don't like adding that to their programs. And the main reason why is that it's slow. You know, this is one of the reasons why, you know, languages which are nice and safe, like Java, are generally, not always, but generally not as fast as writing things in C. So people are disappointed with that solution, even though it would solve our problem. Just bounds check everything. So we're going to look at, you know, some other solutions. But yes, the natural thing to do is bounds checking. Just don't overwrite buffers in the first place. But that turns out to be hard to do efficiently. But often we're going to have other sorts of solutions, which are going to focus on other steps of the exploit. So stopping the return to attacker code. So we weren't going to stop the buffer overflow, but we're not going to actually make the return useful. Or we're going to stop, you know, not execute the attacker code. And there's this whole family of things we do to avoid these exploit techniques like stack smashing, which we're going to call mitigations. So they don't solve the real vulnerability. The vulnerability is that we're overflowing a buffer and writing memory we're not supposed to. but they're going to mitigate the exploits by making it hard to turn that vulnerability, hopefully hard, into something actually dangerous. So today we're going to look briefly at one mitigation. And that's going to motivate us to look at other types of buffer overflows, because one lesson from these mitigations is that they aren't really complete solutions. And this is one mitigation you've actually seen. This is stack canaries. So this was something that was in the assembly code we gave you for RE. And we're going to think about several concerns. We'll look at this more when we look at more mitigations. But we want the mitigation to actually stop the attacker. And we want it to be efficient. You know, we don't want to do bounds checking all the time, because that's like, for every time you write a character, that's a comparison if we do it in an obvious way. So we want something which is much, much faster than that. And people, if you tell them, you know, I'm going to make your program 10 times slower, just in case you screwed up, they're not going to be happy. And in practice, if you tell them, I'm going to make your program 10% slower, just in case you screwed up, they're also not happy. And this is a real challenge for people who want to make programs more secure. So, like many companies, if you said, yeah, we're going to get rid of all these vulnerabilities from your program, but it's going to mean your web server handles 10% less requests, their answer is going to be, I'm going to depend on our secure coding practices instead. I'm going to depend on not missing a check for a buffer, rather than having your solution which adds 10% everywhere, just in case. So stack canaries are one that you actually saw, and that might give you a hint that they really hit this effective and fast, sort of effective, but definitely fast solution. There's also a question of how generic they are. So ideally, we'd have solutions where we just take the existing program and suddenly it's more secure. So since you saw things related to stack canaries in the assembly code you gave you, you can guess that probably doesn't work on existing binaries, because we had to add something to the program. So in RE, we had this funny look at FS. Take this thing from FS, from thread local storage, and sort it on the stack, and then compare that thing at the end of a function. So this value here, which is copied from thread local storage to the stack, is called a stack canary, also called a stack cookie. There's a few bunch of other names in the literature. And the idea is that, like a canary in a coal mine, this is going to tell you when something's going wrong, that you're going to know that, oh, this value changed. Because we're going to check later that did it change. And the idea is that we write some random value for our canary, and it happens to be right before the return address. And so let's say we have a vulnerable function here with a buffer that we can overflow. So with stack canaries, we overflow the buffer, we overwrite the return address to do our stack smashing thing, and now our canary contains something that was in the input we gave. And as long as the attacker can't figure out they were supposed to put B1A, B, and so on there, we have a win. That we're gonna execute this XOR here. It's not gonna be zero because they changed it and they didn't know what to change it to. They couldn't figure that out. And we're gonna call this stack check fail function, which in the program on Linux prints out stack smashing detected and exits. So doesn't matter that they overwrote the return address correctly, we just won't read that return address. Because we'll look at the canary and say, oh, something's wrong, and stop. So the stack canary makes some assumptions. And these assumptions are things which we're going to have more techniques besides stack smashing, for which these aren't true. So there's two big assumptions here. So one is that the assumption is that because the canary is before the return address, that any time you overwrite the return address, you also overwrite the canary. This is true for our usual buffer overflows, but that's not going to be all the ways we have of exploiting things. So we're going to talk about techniques where we don't end up just writing contiguously, we actually can write to just the return address. So if we can somehow skip over the canary, stack canaries won't work. So this works for buffer overruns, but other sorts of memory errors, including memory errors which we can trigger with buffer overruns, are not going to have this property. The other thing we need is that the canary needs to be secret. That we can do our normal stack smashing thing as long as we can fill in these question marks with what was actually in the canary. So the canary needs to actually be secret to the attacker. And since we assume the attacker has our compiler, this means it probably needs to be different every time we run the program. You assume they have the compiler and probably a copy of our executable. So it can't be fixed in the executable. It probably needs to actually be chosen at random each time. And this doesn't do it. And the program better not output it. Typically, that's going to be bad. So this last assumption here is where stack canaries get in the most trouble. So we're assuming that our program never outputs things. But if it's the sort of program which has buffer overruns, it's not unlikely that it's going to have a way of outputting the stack canary. So here's some code which has no buffer overrun, but might accidentally output the stack canary. So I have an 8-byte buffer. I carefully read up to 8 characters, and then print out the buffer. And I initialize the buffer to 0, so it probably is a null terminated string, except if I input exactly 8 characters. But if I input exactly 8 characters, it's not null terminated, and that means I'm going to print out A, if I input A, followed by whatever's on the stack after this buffer. And if that happens to be the stack canary, well, I found out the stack canary. And because we're probably using the same stack canary everywhere, how do we figure out how to insert that code efficiently? I know how to exploit any other buffer overflow in the program. Like, this buffer overflow doesn't cause any problems, but now all that things that made the other buffer overflow safe doesn't work anymore. This appears anywhere on our program. And in practice, this is one of the things people have done to deal with stack canaries, is find some place where you print out addresses from the values from the stack that you aren't supposed to print out. And this can happen in other ways too. So for example here, I have a buffer next to a pointer. This is not something I can do stack smashing on. This is a buffer overflow here. But the buffer overflow is not going to overflow into a return address. It's going to overflow into this pointer that I just read out something from. But that I can make that pointer point to the stack. And I can use this to read the stack canary. So this is not a vulnerability which seems to let me actually execute arbitrary code, especially since I'm only reading from that memory location. So it seems fairly safe, but it might be enough to defeat stack canaries and make my actual stack overflow elsewhere, which I thought was now protected, unsafe. So questions, confusion about this? Okay. So you saw from RE that canaries are something which are implemented all the time. And the real implementation is that they have a nice random canary. And they also play some other tricks, commonly, to make the information disclosure not work as well. But they can't always work. So one thing they do in the GNU, the Linux implementation of stack canaries, is that it has a leading null byte. So this first overflow won't work. This first technique won't work on it. A leading null byte also means that it's a little tricky to put in a buffer overflow. They also have a new line, to also make it tricky to actually put in a buffer overflow. So if you're overflowing a buffer where you can have however much stuff you want, but it has to be terminated by a null character or by a new line, the people who made the Linux implementation of Stack Canaries made it so you can't write the canary with that buffer overflow, because the actual value of the canary contains that followed by other stuff. And they also include the highest, the all one, negative one byte, because that's often also hard to input. Because sometimes people will filter out 8-byte characters, or negative ones for other reasons. These are just heuristics, they don't always work. You can often still exploit these sorts of things. So this is the Linux implementation. So to give you an idea, the sort of minimal, easy things they do against information disclosure, but they don't solve things like this. And bugs like this really do happen. So Stack Canaries are pretty old. So in 1998, there's a paper from Usenix Security, which proposed, I think Usenix Security, which proposed it called Stack Guard. And now they're pretty ubiquitous. So GCC implements them. It has three different variants. And often it's the default. It depends on what type of Linux distribution or other version of GCC you're using. Microsoft C compiler has it. It's on by default now. And the big reason why Stack Canaries are used everywhere is because, well, they really do make it harder to do stack smashing, because you don't even always have an information disclosure bug, and you certainly need to do a lot of extra work. And they're efficient. So if you add Stack Canaries, if you add that check at the beginning, that if you write the canary to the stack at the beginning of a function and check at the end, and you only do it for risky functions, you only do it for functions which like have a character array in them or something like that, then it's about like less than 1% overhead, which is great. So I'm not telling you I'm going to make your program handle 10% less requests in order to, just in case you screwed up in writing your code that manipulates arrays, I'm telling you I'm going to make it less than 1% slower. I'm going to make you substantially safer. This is a lot better than if you add it to all functions. So in StackGuard, they didn't have this differentiation. And at the time, the overhead was like 5 to 20%, depending on the program. And the overhead is not really bounded, because you know, if you have functions which do very little, that canary check might be like more work than the function does. Like if you have a function which just doesn't add instruction and returns, then the canary check is adding 4 extra instructions to a 2-instruction function. And the space overheads are also pretty small if you're only instrumenting functions which already have a character array on the stack, even though we are using extra space on the stack. Stack Canaries, you know, as a mitigation, they're pretty good. And they don't change the calling convention. It's a recompile. Your compiler can just add this without you needing to do extra work. This is not going to be true of all mitigations that we would talk about. Like, you can't add bounds checking to a C program and have it just work, basically. But you can't like protect existing applications. If you have a library you're linking against and it doesn't use Stack Canaries, well, too bad. You need to recompile that library. And we lose this information leak, and we're going to have other exploits which are going to completely ignore Stack Canaries. So let's take a brief look at what the idea of, you know, things that are going to completely ignore these Stack Canaries. So Stack Canaries are just about dealing with this return address part. So our sort of stack smashing template focused on finding the return address and using that, because that was a pointer to code the application would run and that we could change. But it's not the only thing on the stack. And there's other pointers on the stack that we can change. And some buffers aren't on the stack. And we want to know, is it a problem? Is there some generic technique for them that just works and lets us run machine code? And the answer is going to be yes. So we're going to be in trouble for other buffers, and we're going to be in trouble still with stack canaries, because there's going to be other things on the stack besides return addresses which are interesting to overwrite. But these are going to be a bit more application dependent. And we gave you an example of that last time, before the exam review. We had this example, that if we had score and buffer on the stack, score is sure is an interesting thing to overwrite. It's sort of case dependent. Yeah, so we had that layout where we have our buffer here followed next to our next to our score. And well, if we overflow the buffer, we can just set our score to whatever. So that's pretty bad. But it seems like in this case we just got really lucky, right? I need to basically construct an example where this would be a problem. So you might wonder, quite legitimately, well, is this going to be a problem in real programs? So while there isn't something as generic as return addresses to overwrite, we're going to have things which are more generic than, oh, the score for a quiz you want is on the stack. There's going to be things which are commonly found on the stack or on the heap that are going to be useful for us to overwrite. And so over the next time, we're going to look at some techniques mentioned in this article, which is readable, called Beyond Stack Smashing. So at one point, even many security people thought that stack smashing was the only thing you could do, that something like Stack Canary solves all your problems. No one's going to exploit your program. And this is very wrong. And this article goes over several techniques, and we'll talk about some of them. And they're basically about just not limiting ourselves to overwriting return addresses. Return addresses are not the only things that we commonly find in programs that are fun to overwrite. So there's this one technique called arc injection or return-oriented program, which we'll talk about much more later. But the big things are that we have things other than return addresses to overwrite. So we can overwrite data pointers. And that generally lets us turn that into an exploit. You know, overwrite function pointers. That's really easy. And pointers to pointers. And these things, believe it or not, commonly appear in things we can, in things that are on the stack or on the heap. So one of the discoveries is that, well, we commonly have these pointers that are useful to overwrite. Another part of it is that, that even things you don't think are common, like pointers to function pointers, so pointers to the addresses of functions that are used by the program, those actually are a common pattern in executables. So we have something which is almost as generic as return addresses, not from return addresses. So I'll give you a preview of this first thing, arc injection. So this is something about which Stack Canaries do protect against, but it's worth pointing out. So one thing you might say is, if we just don't let users add machine code to a program or ever figure out the address of the stack, that's going to be good enough. Because one thing we have with stack smashing is we need to not only find the return address and be able to override it without being detected, but we also needed to point to our machine code. And you saw that we randomized where the stack was. So problem solved, right? As an attacker, I can't figure out where my code is that I inserted, so I can't do anything. Well, it turns out that, it's already the code you want to run might already be in the application. That instead of setting the return address to your buffer, maybe you don't know where your buffer is. Well, that doesn't matter. You can just find a thing in the program that does what you want to do and return to there. So this seems like getting lucky. We'll talk in a couple weeks about why this isn't actually getting lucky, that you can do this with pretty much any program. But there's some obvious cases where this might be a problem. Like if there's something that's password protected, well, you just set the return address to the code after the password is checked. But this is even true in cases where there's not something like that, where it's obvious why the code that does what you want to do is in the program. So another technique we're going to look at is overwriting data pointers. And this is going to be very flexible, you know, because overwriting a data pointer is going to give us something that we worried about with stack canaries. So with stack canaries, our assumption was that if you overwrote the return address, you overwrote the stack canary. So here's an example of what some vulnerable code might look like. So we have some value, we have some pointer that are stored on the stack, and we overflow some buffer that's next to that. So after we overflow this buffer, if value and pointer are on the stack, we overwrite value and pointer with our attacker's input. So our attacker, given that we do this assignment here, gets to choose exactly what we write and where we write it. So this is what we'll call an arbitrary memory write. So does everyone understand? So the vulnerability here is that the attacker chooses this arg here, and if they can put whatever they want by overflowing this buffer into the pointer and the value. And later on we write to it. And this is contrived here, but you can see this sort of pattern in a real function which does something with a buffer and then does something with a pointer it was keeping around. This is something which is going to happen in real applications. Yeah. So the question is, should val and pointer be above the buffer if they have higher addresses? Well, this depends on what the compiler does. The compiler is not obliged to allocate things in the order written. So yes, but the assumption is for this to be vulnerable, the compiler needs to lay out the stack in that way. Which maybe the compiler should take this as a reason not to do that, but who knows if they do. But assuming the stack ends up laid out in this way, a common way for that to happen, so either by being declared in the right order, or like things being in an array of strings with pointer, array of like classes that contain a string and a pointer, for example, is a way this can happen. But assuming we have that layout, this gives us an arbitrary memory write. So we can choose a memory address and a value and write something there. So what are some ways we can exploit this as an attacker? How would an attacker use this to get what they want to get done? So what's one thing we can do with this? Yeah, so we can use this sort of layout here to not worry about this stack canary. We can say, okay, I'm going to overwrite this buffer right to this pointer here, but not any further. I'm not going to touch the stack canary. And I'm going to overwrite the pointer to point to where the return address is. I'm going to figure out where the stack is exactly, go through a lot of annoyance, and write the return address there. And then I'm going to choose this value to point to be the address of the buffer. And now I have something which is going to cause my code to run like stack smashing, and I didn't touch the stack canary. So if we ever like use pointers in a function with store stuff on a stack, well, the attacker can look probably, often at least, look carefully at that, and turn that into something like stack smashing that doesn't care about stack canaries. Now, this is pretty annoying because we need to know where the return address is and all the stack location stuff. So we'll talk about some better choices about where to make this pointer point to next time, since I think we're out of time now.